Welcome to New World Notes, jotted down by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll start by looking at the political and economic plight of nearby Haiti. Then we'll step back and look at the broader picture, for Haiti is just an especially clear example of some truly awful global trends. Journalist Johan Hari will discuss the economic exploitation of Haiti. Michael Parenti will show parallels to several other third world countries, quote unquote. And to lighten things up a bit, comedians Bob and Ray will give a comic report on labor management relations from about 1960. Comic, maybe, but all too true. I hope you'll stay tuned. Haiti made the news twice this year. In January, the island suffered a devastating earthquake. In response, the U.S. military sent thousands of troops onto the island. They took over the Port-au-Prince airport to serve their own expedition. This prevented flights carrying relief supplies from landing. What the troops were doing is anybody's guess, for apparently they didn't bring any relief supplies for the Haitians. The best guess I heard was this. This was a military exercise preparing for a future invasion of Venezuela. Haiti made the news later when American pop singer Wyclef Jean announced his intention to run for president of Haiti. Their elections come in November. Jean wasn't allowed to run, nor was the person the Haitians overwhelmingly want to be president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, whom the United States twice deposed. Let's hear the story from that fine British journalist Johan Hari, writing in The Independent on September 17. I've condensed his piece for radio. It's titled, Suffocating the Poor, A Modern Parable. Subhead, they democratically elected a president to stand up to the rich and multinational corporations. So our governments had him kidnapped. Across the world, the poor are kept poor so that the rich can be kept rich. If you grasp the situation, you will see some of the ugliest forces in the world laid out before you, so we can figure out how to stop them. The rubble-strewn island of Haiti is now in the middle of an election campaign that will climax this November. So far, the world has noticed it solely because the Haitian-American musician, Wyclef Jean, wanted to run for president, only to be blocked because he hasn't lived in the country since he was a kid. But there is a much bigger hole in the election. The most popular politician in Haiti by far, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He's not there because, after winning a landslide election, he followed the will of the Haitian people, who demanded he take on the multinational corporations and redistribute enough money that their children wouldn't starve. So our governments had him kidnapped at gunpoint and refused to let him back. Sidebar comment, this was the second time we overthrew Aristide, in February 2004. Back to the text. But we have to start the story a little earlier if this is going to make sense. For over two centuries, outsiders have controlled Haiti. The French enslaved the entire island in the 18th century and worked much of the population to death on sugar and coffee plantations. By the 20th century, Western governments were arming, funding, and fueling the psychopathic dictatorship of the Duvalier family, who slaughtered 50,000 people. All this left Haiti the most unequal country in the world. A tiny elite lives in vast villas in the hills, while below and all around them, the overwhelming majority of the population live in tiny tin shacks with no water or electricity, crammed six to a room. Just 1% of the people own 50% of the wealth and 75% of the arable land. Once the Haitian people were finally able to rise up in 1986 to demand democracy, they obviously wanted the country's wealth to be shared more fairly. They began to organize into a political movement called Lavalas, the Flood, to demand higher wages and higher taxes on the rich, to build schools and hospitals, and subsidies for the half-starved poor. This panicked the elite. And nobody panicked them more than a thin, softly spoken, intellectual slum priest named Aristide, who found himself the crest of this wave. He was born into a bitingly poor family and became a brilliant student. As a priest, he soon became one of the leading exponents of liberation theology, the left-wing Catholicism that says people shouldn't wait passively for justice in the kingdom of heaven, but must demand it here and now. Cardinal Ratzinger, then head of the Inquisition, tried desperately to stamp out this, quote, heresy, unquote. Ratzinger is now Pope. Aristide explained, quote, the rich of my country, a tiny percentage, sit at a vast table overflowing with good food, while the rest of my countrymen are crowded under that table, hunched in the dirt and starving. One day the people under the table will rise up in righteousness. Unquote. On this platform, he was elected in 1990 in a landslide in that country's first free and fair election, taking 64% of the vote. He kept his promise to the Haitian people. He increased the minimum wage from 38 cents a day to $1 a day, demanding that multinational corporations pay a less insulting wage. He tripled the number of free secondary schools. He disbanded the murderous national army that had terrorized the population. Even the International Monetary Fund had to admit that over the Aristide period and just after, Haiti's human poverty indicator dropped dramatically from 46.2% to 31.8%. This is a measure of how likely your kids are to die, starve, or go uneducated. But why would foreign governments care about a small, poor country with only 10 million inhabitants? Ira Kurtzban, an American lawyer based in Haiti, explains, quote, Aristide represented a threat to foreign powers because he spoke for the 85% of his population who had never been heard. If that can happen in Haiti, it can happen anywhere, including in countries where the U.S. and Europe have huge economic interests and extract natural resources. They don't want real popular democracies to spread because they know it will confront U.S. economic interests, unquote. Oxfam called this phenomenon, quote, the threat of a good example, unquote. So, after Haiti had experienced 7 months of democracy, the U.S. toppled Aristide in September 1991. Ordinary Haitians surrounded his home, calling for his return, and they were shot down so indiscriminately that more ammo had to be sent from Guantanamo Bay on Cuba. Their bodies were left in the streets to be eaten by dogs. In 1994, the Clinton administration agreed to return Aristide to power, provided he castrate his own political program and ignore the demands of his people. They made him agree to privatize almost everything, freeze wages, and sack half the civil service. Through gritted teeth, he agreed, and for the remainder of his time in office, tried to struggle through what little progress he could. He was reelected in an even bigger landslide in 2000, but even his tiny shuffles toward redistribution were too much. In 2004, the U.S. and French governments had Aristide kidnapped at gunpoint and dumped him in the Central African Republic. They said he was a dictator, even though the last Gallup poll in a free Haiti found 60% supported him, compared to just 3% backing the alternative imposed on the country by the U.S. A massive campaign of terror and repression followed. The Lavalas Party was banned from running again. Most of the country's democracy activists were jailed. There were huge military assaults on the slums, which demanded Aristide's return. A U.S. Army official explained that the mission was to ensure the Haitians, quote, don't get the idea they can do anything they want, unquote. The next president, René Préval, learned his lesson. He has done everything he was told to by the corporations and governments. He privatized the last remaining scraps owned by the state and used tear gas to break up strikes for higher wages. The Haitian people rejected the whole rigged electoral process, with turnout falling to just under 11%. Today, Aristide is a broken man, living in exile in South Africa, banned from going home. This is part of a pattern. When poor countries got uppity and tried to ask for basic justice, our governments have toppled them. From Iran, wanting to control its own oil in 1953, to Honduras, wanting its workers to be treated decently in 2009. Sidebar comment, and dozens of other examples in between. Back to the text. You don't have to overthrow many governments to terrify the rest. It doesn't have to be this way. This is not the will of the people, in the U.S. or Europe. On the contrary, ordinary citizens are horrified when the propaganda is stripped away and they see the truth. It only happens because a tiny, wealthy elite dominates our foreign policy and uses it to serve their purposes. Low wages and control of other people's economies and resources. The people of Haiti, who have nothing, were bold and brave enough to campaign and organize to take power back from their undemocratic elites. Are we? End of Johann Hari's excellent article, Suffocating the Poor, A Modern Parable. And is the United States heading in the same direction as Haiti? Well, the average wage isn't yet down to 38 cents a day, but we're clearly headed in that direction rather than in the opposite direction. Since 1970, real wages have declined, social benefits have declined, job security has vanished, pensions have been destroyed, jobs have been moved abroad, unions have been destroyed, access to health care has diminished, homelessness has skyrocketed. The richest 1% has gotten much, much richer, while everyone else has gotten poorer. And through legislation and regulation and deregulation, the United States government has actively worked to bring about these changes and has blocked almost every attempt to reverse the trend. 50 years ago, the comedy team of Bob and Ray had a vision of the third worldization of the American economy. It must have seemed extremely, absurdly funny back in 1960, a time of rising wages and benefits and high employment. I suspect it seems less funny today, and closer to the literal truth. Still, as far as dystopian visions go, it's a lot funnier than Orwell's 1984 or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Here are Bob and Ray with an admiring report on the Great Lakes Paperclip Company.
Okay, Wally Blue is standing by in Napoleon, Ohio, with a report. Come in, please, Wally Blue.
Lee Blue here in Napoleon, Ohio, at the Great Lakes Paperclip Company. I have been conducting a survey of industrialists who are trying to contribute to the economic health of our nation, and I've come here to speak to the president of the firm, Mr. Hudley Pierce. Thank you for the warm welcome you gave me, Hudley.
Well, thank you. We're always pleased to have visitors here at the plant.
I was amazed to find such a huge factory devoted to the manufacture of such a small item as paperclips.
Well, actually, we're one of the small fellows in the business. There are several companies much bigger than ours in the paperclip business, but we all have the same problems: waste, inefficiency, goofing off, so forth.
Certainly, but you've been doing your best to fight that sort of thing. I was impressed in that one building I saw. I know you have others, but in that one, there was no machinery whatsoever.
No, we don't have any machinery. You see, we buy our wire in long strips, and then our workers cut them in shorter strips, and then bend them by hand into paper clips.
You must have to get a tremendous price for your product if it's handmade like that.
No, we're actually holding the line on cost there. We sell a box of 100 for 10 cents.
Wow.
And here at the factory for 6 cents a box in gross lots.
How many boxes can you turn out in, say, a week's time?
Well, with all three shifts going, we could make, 200 boxes maybe. And we can clear about $12.
I mean, you can run a big operation like I've seen here and only take in $12 a week?
Well, we have a low wage structure. You see, here again we hold the line on costs. Our average worker makes about 14 cents a week.
That is ridiculous. How could anybody possibly live on 14 cents a week?
We don't pry into the personal lives of our employers, Wally. But as I understand it, our people live in caves on the edge of town. And they forage for food.
I noticed all of your employees seem to be dressed in rags. They have little strips of cloth tied around their feet.
Well, you can't wear shoes when you make 14 cents a week. I guess that's obvious to everybody.
I guess so. That would probably account for a lot of the grumbling I heard while I was over there.
I'm sure it would, yes.
Still can't understand how anybody can work on a salary like you've described.
Well, there are a few loopholes in our union contract. For instance, there's no mention of wages at all. But there is a provision that makes the worker liable for prosecution and imprisonment if he tries to quit.
I imagine the union will have that changed the first chance it gets, huh?
Well, no, we have what's called a 99-year sweetheart contract. And it has 86 years to run, so we're in pretty good shape.
Well, you've got some time to look ahead, Mr. Pearson. Thanks again for the welcome I got out here. A tip of our hat to you in your fight against all of this waste and corruption.
Thank you very much.
Hudley Pearce, the Great Lakes Paperclip Factory. Thank you, Hudley.
Now let's look at the broader picture. Since World War II, the United States has invaded lots and lots of countries and overthrown lots and lots of governments, many of them friendly to the U.S., many of them democracies. In a lecture from, I believe, 1993, political scientist Michael Parenti shows what these countries had in common. They attempted to introduce economic reforms to better serve their own common people. They tried to be something other than just a colony to transnational neoliberal capitalism and its enforcement arm, the United States government. Sometimes they merely tried to raise the minimum wage the foreign sweatshop owners would have to pay their workers, as happened in Honduras just last year. The name Haiti comes up again and again, along with dozens of other names. Here's a selection from Michael Parenti.
The U.S. empire has given more than $200 billion in military aid to train, equip, and subsidize over 2 million troops and internal security forces in over as 80 countries. The purpose is being not to defend them from outside invasion, but to defend the ruling oligarchs in these countries from their own populations. Among the recipients of U.S. military aid have been some of the worst murderers and military autocracies on earth, such as Turkey, Zaire, Chad, Morocco, Kuwait, Indonesia, and others too numerous to mention. Haiti, before Aristide, and after Aristide. Over the past four decades, the U.S. launched or assisted in the overthrow of popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Greece, Argentina, Bolivia, and Haiti in 91, and numerous other countries. And then supported the conservative military autocracies that replaced them. Well, now, if a goal of U.S. foreign policy is democracy, how do you serve the cause of democracy throughout the world by overthrowing so many democracies? And why did you overthrow them? Hostile actions by the U.S. leaders have been directed against reformist governments in Egypt, South Yemen, Lebanon, Peru, Iran under Mossadegh, the Congo under Lumumba, the Fiji Islands, and you can go on. Since World War II, U.S. military forces have directly invaded or launched aerial attacks, killing large numbers of people in Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, and Somalia. Before World War II, the U.S. invaded Haiti, Soviet Russia, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. The nations that feel the brunt of U.S. intervention are not randomly selected. Generally, intervention is directed against governments that have sought to establish political economic independence. Governments that have either tried to drop out of the global free market capitalist system or within the confines of it tried some kind of independent development and redistributive politics. By redistributive politics, I mean that they took some portion of the gross national income and redistributed from column A to column B. From the people in column A, that 2% that live off interest and dividends and land royalties and rents, to the people in column B, the other 98% who live off wages, salaries, commissions, fees, and pensions. And those governments that have pursued that kind of policy are the ones which have been targeted for U.S. intervention. It could be a populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijos and Noriega, or in Egypt under Nasser. It could be a Christian revolutionary one, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democratic popular front government, as in Chile under Allende, or in Greece under Papandreou back in the 1960s. It could be a Marxist-Leninist one, as in Cuba or North Korea or Soviet Union. It could be an Islamic revolutionary government, as in Libya under Gaddafi. Even a conservative militarist government, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. I mean, Saddam Hussein was CIA. I mean, who do you think brought him in and got the king out of Iraq? It was the CIA. But he got to be a little too nationalistic. He started to get out of line on oil prices and oil quotas. The goal of U.S. global policy is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. The purpose is not just to protect direct investments. I mean, there was very little direct investment, U.S. investment in Vietnam, for instance, or in Soviet Russia back in 1920 when the U.S. invaded with 12 other countries. It's to protect the overall global capitalist system. Take the case of Grenada. I remember saying to an acquaintance, I said, why doesn't Reagan invade Grenada? I mean, here's a little revolutionary country of 102,000 people. It's perfectly helpless, and he's a bully, and he would take it, you know, and it's trying a revolutionary course. And then I came to the conclusion, and it was foolish of me to say this, I said, oh, it's too small. It's ridiculous to go take U.S. forces and invade. And I didn't realize that nothing's too small for Ronald Reagan. And sure enough, he invaded Grenada. Well, what's the purpose of it? Capitalism would not collapse if Grenada remained revolutionary. And Reagan was right. It wasn't a matter of direct resources that you needed from that country. He said, nutmeg is not the question. I mean, that was Grenada's biggest export. We could get perfectly good nutmeg from Africa. You don't need Grenada's nutmeg. So why did they invade Grenada? They invaded Grenada because they were serving notice to the people of the Caribbean and to the people of Latin America and to the people of the world that you cannot drop out of your client state free market system. That if you try to take an independent source, and that if you use your land, your labor, your resources, and your capital, and your markets in a different way, in a collectivist way, if you use them to benefit the needs of your people rather than to be milked like a cow for foreign investors or whatever else, if you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. And the rest of the Caribbean got the message. In the same way, reason Indonesia invaded East Timor. There may be oil in East Timor, or there may not. But the thing that there was a revolutionary government that was trying to effect these kinds of social changes. And this counter-revolutionary policy prevails regardless of the party or personality that's in the White House. Whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, it doesn't matter. This policy obtains. The process of keeping the world's land, labor, resources accessible at cheap prices for the multinational investors, that process has a name. It's called imperialism. The I word, which is really not allowed to be mentioned very often. And if you're practicing imperialism, then you have an empire. So in its financial and in its military reach, the United States empire builders have created the greatest empire in history, far greater in scope and power than Great Britain in the 19th century or Rome of ancient times. The goods made abroad by super exploited labor are, by the way, sold at as high as possible price on U.S. markets. You could hear people say, well, maybe I get a break as the consumer. They go abroad, but they produce those goods more cheaply, and I get to buy them more cheaply. That's not true. Now, come on, now, be real. Be grown up. It's amazing people you run into, the kind of goo-goo baby-like thinking they have about the people up there in power, hoping that they'll be benign to us, you know. Maybe they're doing this for me. They're doing it for you? You think they went all the way to Indonesia for you? You think Nike has closed every single one of its factories in America and went to Indonesia, where they pay these young women in compounds, which amount to slave labor, they pay them 10 and 12 cents an hour? You think they did that for you? No, because when those shoes, which the final production cost is $7, when those shoes get back stateside, they sell them for $134. They don't go there for you. They go there for themselves to widen that margin, to get cheap labor costs so that they can then make more profits. When they go down to Haiti and employ people for $1 a day, and that radical President Aristide wants to raise the minimum wage to $2. The World Bank got him against the wall, said, "You're going to go back, but you just drop that stuff about minimum wage and those crazy radical ideas. It costs 10 cents to make a baseball in Haiti." No, I'm sorry, wait a minute. 12 cents. It costs 12 cents to make a baseball. They stitch those baseballs in Haiti, which then sell here in the U.S. for $10 and up. What's the markup on that, 12 cents to $10? How many 1,000%? Even take off for transportation costs, whatever else.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. For more information, great links, and pretty pictures, plus my email address if you'd care to get in touch, see our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and let's keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true. Let's go out on a bit of music by Haitian-American singer Wyclef Jean.
You hear the choir, you don't want no drama. Someone gonna end up in a coma. Drama, can't they hear the choir? Someone gonna end up in a coma. I got the heart of a warrior. Ain't a thing that you can do to hide. You won the battle, but you didn't win the war. Look out the window, see 100,000 more. Warriors, warriors, warriors. See, I'm a warrior, and I don't back down. When I'm hit up, bite the bullet, brush myself off. Then I see the fear clear in my enemy's eyes. He see the warrior, now where my warriors? Yeah, yeah. Warriors come out to play. In my gangland's revolutionary music. But I got a cousin in the gang. He used to bang, gave me a ring. He said, cousin, let me tell you a reason. If a man snitch, we call that treason. I never left the hood without my body armor. I was raised on the cold death before dishonor. And what's funny, I could have been that way. If I never made it, red dot pointed at your head. And send you to your new home, a mansion in the ocean. Where your flesh will be carried to land by Miami Dolphins. I ain't no gangster, but I know gangsters. I ain't no killer. Are you a killer? Cause I seen killers kill killers, robbing drug dealers. That's why I'd rather sell music with my online warriors. You hear the